content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Cindy Fowler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Dave's Garden e-newsletter, the Garden Smart website, the North Carolina State Extension e-newsletter, the Triangle Gardener magazine, and maybe from Luis Riot's Carrots Love Tomatoes and Roses Love Garlic. We'll start out with Dave's Garden e-newsletter. We forget the water cycle and the life cycle are one. That was said by Jacques Cousteau. 10 drought-tolerant plants to include in your garden by Laura Foreman. These plants can thrive in even the driest conditions. Hot summer temperatures and reduced rainfall can make any garden look gloomy this time of year. Many drought-prone areas have water restrictions, so watering isn't always an option. However, there's still a way to maintain a beautiful summer garden. Cultivate plants that are sure to survive the heat and water limitations. Here are a few good varieties, as well as tips to keep them looking lush. Lantana. With flowers that range from orange and red to pink and purple, lantana is a fiery flower for any garden. It can grow to be 8 feet tall and 4 feet wide, but there are more compact varieties available for those who don't have a lot of space to work with. The lantana may be known for its showy flowers, but it also boasts blue-green, chartreuse, and gold foliage. Salvia, a member of the mint family, salvia features blue and purple flowers and thrives in hot, dry conditions. Grows to about 30 inches tall. Salvias, or sages, make for fragrant additions. Although it grows best in sunny locations with well-drained soil, you may be able to grow it in partial shade. Encourage it to bloom by removing existing blooms as they fade. Coneflower, also known as echinacea, it's a colorful flower that resembles the cheerful daisy. Attracting butterflies and bees, coneflowers do best with full sun and well-drained soil. They spread quickly and come back again year after year. Lavender, known for strong fragrance, it grows to about 3 feet tall and can thrive in even the poorest soil. How? You may have to add some compost or other organic matter in to improve drainage if you have clay soil. Cut lavender sprigs after the plant has bloomed to bring its fresh, relaxing fragrance indoors. Agastache. A member of the hyssop family, agastache features tall blue and purple flower spires and grows well in poor soil. Easy to grow, it thrives in full sun. You may need to water the plant more while it's getting established. It should be drought tolerant and low maintenance thereafter. Russian sage. This fragrant plant grows up to 5 feet tall and is a showstopper in any garden. All it needs is sun. It even does well in poor soil. The best part is it needs little watering once it's become established. Although it resembles lavender, it has a scent that's all its own. Artemisia. If foliage is your thing, you'll love Artemisia's silvery blue-green leaves, which have been known to form mounds between 3 and 5 feet tall. These tough plants also spread as wide as 10 feet in some cases. Yarrow, a hardy, low-maintenance plant, a favorite of both bees and butterflies, yarrow features compacted flower heads with tons of small flowers in shades of yellow, pink, red, and white. It's also extremely fragrant and can be cut for its fresh flowers. Verbena. An ideal accent for containers, verbena is easy to grow and will only shoot up to about 3 feet in height. The flowers will bloom all season long, and the plant consistently produces new flower buds. The colorful verbena is ideal for small gardens and container gardens. Sedum. Every garden needs low-growing ground cover. Sedum grows best in well-drained soil that is average to rich in fertility. It also thrives in full sun and is often easiest to grow from divisions or cuttings. Although they may be finicky while growing, they require little care once they've established themselves. By dividing these plants up twice a year, you can prevent them from spreading too much throughout the garden. And tips. Drought-tolerant plants tend to be relatively low maintenance, especially once they're established. Of course, low maintenance does not necessarily mean no maintenance. Apply mulch to help conserve moisture, keep weeds down, and keep the soil a steady temperature. Water occasionally, especially during extreme drought. Although drought-tolerant plants will survive some periods of drought or low water, they may need supplemental watering during extreme drought, especially if they're not yet established. Use drip irrigation to ensure an efficient delivery of water. You'll use less because less water is wasted through evaporation. Water in the morning or later in the day. There are some that are drought tolerant but high maintenance. Plant few for effect. Don't rely on them to carry your landscape. Native plants tend to be low maintenance because they're adapted to thrive in your environment. These plants are sure to thrive in your garden. Contact your local Master Gardener program to learn more about what plants grow best in your area. And from Dave's Garden e-newsletter, The Sweet-Scented History of Sweet Peas by Audrey Stahl-Smith. What frilly flower took the Victorian world by storm? I never have much luck with annual sweet peas, probably because a procrastinator such as myself never plants them early enough. Cool season annuals don't like hot weather. They theoretically should be sown in early spring to bloom in early summer. I tried to start this year, but they're still anemic and flowerless in their container as of early August. I'm hoping they last until cooler weather arrives, when they might begin to perk up. The perennial sweet pea apparently isn't much bothered by sizzling temperatures because a mass remains in bloom near the corner of our road. Years ago, the owner of that plot sold bulbs and perennials to customers, so I suspect he was the one who originally sowed those. Unfortunately, the perennial lacks what people love about sweet peas, their fragrance. The first sweet peas, I have a vague recollection that heirloom Coupani bloomed amiably enough for me one summer, but tolerates heat better than most modern hybrids do. The first sweet pea that appeared in print in 1695, it eventually would be named for Francisco Coppina, the monk who oversaw Sicily's botanical garden. Although many wild Lathyrus sweet peas grew around the world at that time, it can be argued few were as striking and fragrant as that ruby and amethyst gem. The red and white painted lady is considered the first official cultivar, appearing around 1731. Like Coupani, it only had two flowers per stem. Henry Eckford, once head gardener to the Earl of Radnor, would develop the larger sweet peas known as grandifloras, though he moved on to working for Dr. Sankey. Eckford reportedly sprung the first of his 115 cultivars, Bronze Prince, on the gardening world in 1882. One of his pink types, Prima Donna, would prove important as well. Across the pond in the U.S., a much more amateur gardener, a quarryman's wife in New York, inadvertently succeeded in taming sprawling Lathyrus foliage. She had been growing Painted Lady on limestone ledges for years. To survive their shallow planting, those sweet peas eventually developed a more compact size and an inclination to all bloom at once. The DM Ferry Company would begin to market that variety as Blanche Ferry in 1889. Good breeding and the Spencers. Meanwhile, back in England, another head gardener was quick to follow Eckford's lead. Silas Cole, who worked for the Earl of Spencer, came up with the first wavy variety, which was about one-fourth larger than the Grandifloras. He had bred it by crossing Lovely and Triumph, and then pairing the resulting blooms with Prima Donna. He eventually named his new cultivar Countess Spencer after his employer's wife. He actually had come close to losing the botanical Countess altogether, though, as he only was able to save 5 seeds from his first plant, and 3 of those were eaten by mice. The Spencer varieties would become highly popular, due, no doubt, to their flirty flounces and aristocratic name. Cut flower grower W.J. Unwin produced his similarly larger and frillier sweet pea in a more easy-peasy manner. He simply found it growing among his prima donna blooms and saved seeds, naming the sport Gladys Unwin after his daughter. Sports are botanical accidents, which generally occur due to genetic mutation. Of course, he did have to continue growing the new cultivar for a while to ensure it would retain its characteristics before he began selling his seeds. In years since, breeders have gone on to develop even sweeter peas, such as the Blue Vein. But I still like to think that such things evolve when all avid gardeners, from a quarryman's wife to an Earl's Head horticulturalist, keep a protective and discerning eye on their favorite plants. And now, from the Garden Smart website, 5 Watering Myths Debunked by Suzanne DeJohn. During droughts, it's especially important to make every drop count, but even during more normal summer weather, it still makes sense to conserve this precious resource. There's a wealth of watering information out there, some fact, some fiction. Here are 5 common myths. Myth 1. Plants need 1 inch of water per week. This often cited figure does not take into account that plants vary widely in their water needs. Seedlings, for example, have limited root systems and may need daily watering, especially during hot, sunny weather. Established trees and shrubs, on the other hand, should have extensive root systems and may do just fine with what nature provides, needing supplemental watering only during extended dry spells. In reality, a plant's water needs depends on many factors, including the type of plant, its stage of growth, type of soil, weather, and time of year. A berm of soil around these transplants ensures that water will soak into the root zone rather than running off. Learn how to create a water-wise garden. When you water a plant, apply enough to moisten the plant's entire root system, which may extend deeper and wider than you imagine. Then allow the soil to dry out slightly before watering again. Apply water slowly so it's absorbed by the soil rather than running off. A soaker hose or drip system is ideal. Avoid daily light sprinklings, which encourage roots to grow near the soil surface where they're vulnerable to drying out. Rather than relying on a schedule, water plants when they need it. Poke a finger into a planter or use a trowel to carefully dig near a plant to check soil moisture. Myth. Wilting is a sign that it's time to water. Wilting is a sign that the leaves are not getting enough water, but that does not necessarily mean that the soil is dry. Anything that damages plant roots can prevent them from taking up water. Roots need access to both air and water. Too little water and the roots die from lack of moisture. Too much water and roots can suffocate from lack of air. Both situations reduce the root's ability to deliver enough water to stems and leaves, resulting in wilting. Root diseases, physical damage, such as from hoeing or shoveling, and soil-borne insects can also harm roots. Damage to stems can also cause wilting. Some diseases and insects, especially borers, prevent water distribution throughout the plant, causing some or all of it to wilt. The only way to tell if lack of water is causing wilting is to check soil moisture. Myth. Overhead watering on a sunny day can scorch leaves. It's wise to avoid using a sprinkler to water your garden on a sunny afternoon because much of the water will be lost to evaporation. But the idea that water droplets act like tiny magnifying glasses and burn plant leaves has no basis in fact. Leaf damage can be caused by all sorts of things, including too much or too little soil moisture, fertilizer burn from improperly diluted synthetic fertilizer, herbicides, insect or disease problems, weather conditions such as wind or frost. Myth: overhead watering with a sprinkler is bad. Yes, it's usually best to apply water directly to the soil around plants rather than watering with a sprinkler. More water reaches roots. Less water is lost to evaporation. Foliage stays dry, minimizing disease problems. There are times when overhead shower is called for. During dry, windy weather, a thin layer of dust can build up on leaves, reducing the plant's ability to photosynthesize efficiently. Some insects, including aphids and spider mites, can be kept in check by simply hosing them off plants. Finally, heat-stressed plants that have wilted, even though their roots are moist, can get some relief from a cooling shower. Myth: drought-tolerant plants do not need to be watered. Many young echinacea, sedum, and black-eyed Susan plants have perished because these drought-tolerant plants did not get a sufficient water at planting time and during season of growth. When you set out a new container-grown plant, the roots are confined to the shape of the pot. The plants need a consistent supply of water during their first growing season until their roots grow out into the surrounding soil. Water them as you would your annual flowers in their first season. During their second and subsequent growing seasons, drought-tolerant plants may need supplemental water only during extended dry spells. Note, however, that just because a plant is drought-tolerant does not mean it does not fare better with a regular supply of moisture. From the Triangle Gardener magazine, in the garden, July through August, flowers. Fertilize container plants every week to 10 days and keep these watered, sometimes twice a day if in full sun. Deadhead perennials and annuals for continued blooming. Refresh your annuals with new ones. Cut back plants that are leggy or struggling. Check your vegetable garden daily for water needs. Fertilize weekly as these plants are heavy feeders. Keep watch for diseases and insects. Watch for blossom end rot on tomatoes. Provide plenty of water and some fertilizer. Provide light shade if blossom drop is a problem. Start planting the fall garden. Turnip, broccoli, cabbage, and cauliflower can be direct seeded into the garden in August. Harvest vegetables and fruits in the morning, not during the heat of the day. Place the harvest in a cool place to prevent deterioration of taste. Donate some of your extra produce to a local food bank. And trees and shrubs. Stop pruning evergreens and hedges in late August. New growth from late pruning can be harmed in winter. Fertilize shrubs in August and then not until spring. Japanese beetles are here. You can hand-pick them off the plant or use traps if you clean these daily. The single most effective means of reducing mosquito populations is to eliminate standing water. And don't fertilize your fescue lawn until fall. And keep your mower blade sharp. Smooth cuts cause less moisture loss of the blades of grass. Mowing heights for your lawn are important. If needed, water your lawn in early morning to avoid evaporation in the heat of the day. And events coming up: Hyper Tufa Trough and Concrete Leaf Workshop, August the 24th. Make a Hyper Tufa Trough, 9 a.m. to 12 noon. Concrete Leaf Workshop, 1 to 3 p.m. There is a fee and you need to pre-register. To register, email amelia.lane@gmail.com. And a photography walk. Visual storytelling, capturing a sense of place with your camera. That happens August the 29th, 8:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. In this session, you'll learn some easy-to-implement techniques to go beyond the snapshot to visually tell the story of the experience of being in a place. There is a fee, and you need to pre-register. This will happen at the J.C. Ralston Arboretum in Raleigh. Call 919-515-3132. 919-515-3132 for more information. And from the NC State Extension e-newsletter, a summer workshop, Therapeutic Horticulture, from 8:23 to 24 in Hendersonville, North Carolina, Carolina's Horticulture Therapy Network. Burlington Gardens in Hendersonville, North Carolina, will be hosting the next meeting. They'll start a workshop Friday, 4 o'clock for those who can make it, and you'll make your own walking stick. Bring in an apron or change of clothes, because it's a dusty process. At 6 p.m. Friday, we'll meet at the brand new Point Lookout Vineyard, which is not far from Burlington. You don't want to miss this. We'll provide hors d'oeuvres, but there will be a food truck at the vineyard, and you're welcome to bring other food as well. They make about a dozen types of wine and some different meals. Saturday morning, you can check in at Bullington beginning at 8:15, and we'll have coffee, tea, and some light breakfast fare. We'll begin with introductions at 9. You can see the rest of the day in the attached agenda. Lunch will be provided. In the afternoon, we would like to have an activity swap, so if you have a great HT activity, write it up on the form and bring it. We'll photocopy for everyone. Also, if the activity results in a product, bring a sample for us to see. You can register at the meeting online, CHTN August registration, or by downloading the form and mailing a check. We have not nailed down a hotel yet, but appreciate knowing how much interest there is in getting a group rate at something nearby. I'm sure I have forgotten something, and this won't be your last you hear from me. We look forward to seeing you all. And that is from the North Carolina, Carolina's Horticulture Therapy Network by Lucy Bradley. And now from Louise Riotte's Carrots Love Tomatoes and Roses Love Garlic. Here's some information on meadow saffron. This plant blooms in fall and will do so even without soil around its poisonous bulbs. Colchicum, derived from the bulbs, is the source of a present-day drug used to treat gout and also has been used to produce doubling or chromosomes in plants. Meadowsweet. Meadowsweet is perhaps the most important of all nature's remedies. Chemists discovered acetylsalicylic acid in this plant, synthesized it, and called it aspirin. But the dried leaf in its natural form can be ground with mortar and pestle and used whenever, wherever aspirin is recommended without aspirin's side effects. Meadowsweet is particularly recommended by herbalists as an antidote for rheumatism, arthritis, gout, and all kidney and bladder complaints, particularly gravel and cystitis. Mescal bean. The beautiful green glossy leaves and the display of fragrant sweet pea-like lilac flowers borne in a droopy inflorescence are very impressive. This excellent landscape plant is particularly good for poor alkaline soils and tolerates heat and drought well. The beautiful seeds are large, brilliant, and coral. And even though they are very poisonous, the Mexicans use them for necklaces. Powdered seeds of this flowering shrub are toxic to army worms. Mexican hat. This flower, dark mahogany red or yellow with a red blotch, is a form of the prairie coneflower, the dramatic yellow daisy with cone-shaped brown center. The perennial plant is about 1 foot tall, and given full sun, it will bloom continuously from summer to fall. Grow it with the purple coneflower, which is taller, 3 to 5 feet, and also flowers from summer to fall. The lavender purple daisies make excellent cut flowers. Martinia, devil's claw, unicorn plant. Sonoran tribes domesticated this plant for the long black fibers of the claws on the fruit. They were used in basket weaving. The seeds may be eaten like sunflower seeds or pressed for oil. The fuzzy green seed pods are picked when half grown if wanted for pickling. The strange mature pods are often used for decorations. Marigold. The marigold, herb of the sun, is as helpful in the flower garden as in the vegetable garden, serving in the same purpose of driving away nematodes. They are particularly useful with chrysanthemums, calendulas, and dahlias. Brown areas on lower leaves signal the underground feeding of the foliar nematodes. Mignonette, little darling, has a low bushy mass of smooth soft green leaves. Tiny flowers on tall spikes are yellowish white with reddish pollen stalks. The larger flowered varieties are prettier but less fragrant. The mignonette is a good border plant that grows best in cool temperatures and light soil. If the seed fails to sprout, check for ants. They have been known to carry off the seed. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Cindy Fowler, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.